Hey guys, just before we jump into the episode today, we would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we record this podcast today. We pay our respects to the elders past and present, and we extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people here today. This episode is brought to you by the Psych Collaborative, our online psychology clinic bringing good quality, accessible therapy to you in the comfort of your own home. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode. My name is Kat. I am a registered psychologist.
And my name is Amy. I am a registered psychotherapist.
And together we are the Psychology Sisters. We are a podcast dedicated to normalizing the mental health conversation. Darling, sweet, festive Christmas elf, Amy, how are you? How's life? Give me the update.
Christmas festive elf. feeling very, very festive. Not so much elf-like, but very festive. Getting ready to wind down for the year. Lots of social things happening, which I'm sure a lot of people can relate to around this time of year. Lots of Christmas parties and coming out of lockdown. So all very exciting that we get to go out and see people again. But by the same token, also feeling a little bit tired, social battery a little bit drained from all of the socializing that maybe my little system is just not so used to, but overall, quite good. How are you, Katniss?
I'm good. I'm very much looking forward to Chrissy and everything coming up. It's starting to get exciting. You know how, like, at first it was triggering? And it's like, oh, God, it's happening. I can't turn around. I can't turn back. It's now kind of getting to the exciting part because work is wrapping up. Brains have checked out. Summer or sunshine is back. We've had a few sunny days. Don't want to jinx it. Touch wood. There's a bit of sunshine back. So it's starting to feel a little bit like Christmas, a little bit like summer, little reminders that the end is near, my friends. We are very close, very excited to have. I've made it sound like it's the worst year of the world. Like the end is near, like almost
it
there.
It has been a tough year. It has been a tough year.
Yeah. So let's reflect on the year. This will be our last episode for this year and then we will be back in your ears next year. But we're going to do a bit of a end of year reflection and some listener Q&As. But before we get into that, Ames, talk to me about your year. Talk to me about your reflection, your highs, your lows. Maybe do a yearly pit and peak if you have one. We haven't prepared for this. I've just put you on the spot.
I know. Feeling massively on the spot. Okay, yearly reflection. 2021, I was almost going to say 2020 because I guess when reflecting on the year, it has kind of felt a little bit like a flow on from 2020. It's hard to distinguish between 2020 and 2021. But I guess all in all, 2021 has been, I think, the year of, I don't know, patience. I think maybe that sounds a little bit lame, but upon reflection, I think 2021 has taught me to be a little bit more patient. I think in general, I mean me, can be quite impatient. And I think I was forced to be patient in 2021, which isn't a bad thing. I think oftentimes we have reflected on this together, a little bit, Kat, in conversations around lockdown and coronavirus, that it has also made us appreciative of the smaller, more simple things. Mm. And slowing down a little bit more. Not that we are taking our advice at the moment, but I think, 2021 was a slower, more patient year where I guess we did practice a lot of gratitude for the smaller things that we, you know, we may not have otherwise recognized or acknowledged, but it did not come without challenge. I think 2021 was a very stressy, anxiety inducing year for myself and for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It was a very isolating year, I think, for myself. When I reflect on 2021, I don't live close really to any of my friends or family, so it was quite an isolating, oftentimes lonely year. And again, I think that is quite a common shared experience to differing degrees and severities for people. But it was the longest amount of time I went without seeing people like my dad and my friends. And it was really tough in that respect. And I think, again, reflecting on things that I'm grateful for, definitely the beautiful, amazing people that I have in my life, and just how much absolutely this time of year does feel extra special and exciting around Christmas, often, you know, reconnecting, spending time with people that maybe we haven't seen in a really long time because of lockdown and that type of thing. So I'm definitely much more acknowledging of the people that are in my life from having had that experience. I think if I had to think of a peak, it would be going full time with the Psych Collaborative together. Yeah. That was such an awesome achievement for us both, and just such a, I think, milestone moment, which I feel very lucky and grateful for as well. Over to you, Kat. What is your end of year wrap up, reflection, yearly pit and peak, challenges, peaks and troughs of the year that has been?
Highs, lows.
It's another synonym for
the highs and the lows.
The ups and the downs.
I'm sorry to hear about the year that you had. I think that's such a, you know, as much as a lot of people experienced it, it still doesn't make it any less easy to feel that loneliness and isolation. So, sending all my love to you, my friend. I'm so glad we can see each other again and you have access to all those other things that hopefully bring you that joy now lockdown is over. But it's been a really tough year, especially because living so far, and you certainly do enjoy nature and the beach, and being so far from that, it's been very tough on you, my dear angel face friend.
Thank you.
In terms of my yearly pit and peak, yeah, I've really put you on the spot and me on the spot because I have no idea what my yearly peak would be. I think my yearly pit would be, yeah, just not taking my own advice, I think, would be the biggest one. I think I know it's been quite slow and we've been forced to pause, which has been lovely. I think, well, I felt quite busy. I felt really nonstop this year. I certainly did not prioritize a lot of time looking after myself and having a lot of the self-care time. I think when you're starting a business and working two jobs and managing all the other fun stuff as well, it's a lot. So I think I certainly felt it this year. I felt it, you know, when you start to relax or have a bit of an end point, your body's just like, shut down, goodbye. I really felt it quite strongly then, the shutting down, which is indicative of, I guess, how busy and crazy and frantic we were. And I'm obviously so appreciative that we could work during the lockdown period, but I think it certainly has been such a busy time for us. So yeah, I think that was my pit. I think I regret not looking after myself a little bit better and not prioritizing me. But my peak would certainly be going full time with the PC. I think I share that peak with you, Ames. It's been so incredible to have that exciting dream come true. We sat down like 2 years ago, maybe give or take, with a pipe dream to have our own business and to see clients and have beautiful, you know, have a really beautiful client base. And I think we've achieved all of that plus some. So very proud of us. That's certainly been the peak. And I think probably ironic that probably without the pit, I couldn't have had the peak. So I think the, you know, the hard work and the business does kind of contribute a lot to business and things like that. But I'm very proud that we did it, that we made it. And yeah, on to big things next year, I hope.
Absolutely. Well, you've had a huge year. You bought a house, planned wedding 3.0, balanced two jobs, and then, yeah, going full-time. Like, you have had a really, really hectic year.
Well, yeah, I think everyone has. And I just loosely, you know, planning wedding 3.0, let's loosely just put procrastinating wedding 3.0. Haven't really done much until now, so. But no, it's certainly been a big year nonetheless. Yeah. So, yeah.
Very, very easy for, I guess, self-care practices to fall by the wayside when we have so much big stuff happening.
Yep, they are the first to go. Hasta luego. Hasta luego. Adios. Do as we say, not as we do, dear friends. Alrighty. So thought today we could just do a bit of an end of year Q&A. We had some lovely listeners write in with their questions on our Instagram. So we will try and get through as many as we can, but knowing us, we will take forever. So we'll try and get through as much as we can. But just before we jump into the questions, the information that we share is general in nature and does not replace personalized psychological advice. Ames, you want to start us off? What is the first question?
I was just about to ask you if you'd like to start us off. but maybe I can ask you the first question. Katniss, question number one. How to protect your energy around toxic family members?
Oh, this is a really good question and so topical and timely coming into a season or a festive season where we are often mostly around family for a lot longer than what we normally are. Mm. So really great question. I think protecting your energy around toxic family members is important. So firstly, it's good to acknowledge that you know, you may feel triggered, that your energy may be a little bit lower coming into this time of year, and that you are entitled to feel all the feels when being around toxic family members. Remember that often with someone like family, it's very easy to feel triggered. I think if there's been repeated patterns of behavior or violation of boundaries or dismissal of emotion, then obviously our anxiety will likely be heightened, which means we're more hypersensitive to any triggers, any threats coming from our family members in our environment. So I think acknowledgement that likely when you go back into an environment or are in an environment around family members that feel toxic, that you will be very hypervigilant and hyper aware around all of their behaviors or anything they say or don't say or do, etc. So as always, when we're speaking about protecting your energy, I think it's really helpful to always bring in boundaries where possible. I know that that's not always possible if you do live with family members or if, yeah, you don't have that space. But even if you do have for example, your own room, like having a physical boundary, which is being able to have your own space, an emotional boundary where you can, you know, discuss, I don't like the way you talk to me here, or I will not accept this behavior, or, you know, that's another boundary you can put in place. I think as well, just to highlight with boundaries, that it can create conflict on the other end. It can create defensiveness. It can create anger for the person that you're putting the boundaries in place with. So boundaries are a really, really tricky thing to implement sometimes, especially because we may not want to create more conflict or more anger or more toxicity than what is already around. But I think they're really, really important. Even if it's just a physical boundary of having your own space, sometimes that can be really helpful. Having your own safety and your own safe haven away from family members can be helpful. But if you are, for example, you know, if this is what this person is asking, going home for Christmas, or if you're going to be around family members that you're not used to being around, boundaries can still look like, look, I just need to go out to my car for a second. I need to go outside and take a phone call. I'm just going to go for a short walk. Just taking yourself out of the situation can be helpful. If the festive season has been the reason this person has asked this question, also just your own emotional regulation practices of, you know, whether it might be deep breaths or labeling how you're feeling or creating space and validation for however you're feeling. I think sometimes we might feel shame or anger or guilt or whatever it might be for reacting to maybe toxic family members, or, you know, I think knowing that it's okay to feel all those things, but having your own self-soothing practices in place can be really helpful too, and your own support network, I think, would be a really good thing to think about or to implement as well. So Ames, what do you think? Anything to add on to that?
I love that answer. Really, really beautiful things to keep in mind there. I think the issue of distancing from toxic family members is really complicated and really unique, I guess, to the individual family dynamic. I think, unfortunately, many families with a history of adverse childhood experiences or trauma sometimes view these dynamics or behaviors as normal because they are so familiar, and that can make it really tricky to navigate as well. because it does induce a great deal of distress, as you're explaining, Kat. Our nervous system can pick up on a lot of these behaviors and traits. And I would say this is actually one of the most common or frequent questions I hear as a clinician is how to cope or how to protect my energy around a toxic family member. And I think this is also really broad too. So when this person is saying toxic family member, we could be talking about anything from narcissistic abuse and how to cope with manipulation tactics like silent treatment, stonewalling, criticism, and that type of thing to referring to what we have referred to on the podcast before as a case of energy vampire. So those family members that are just really quite draining on your energy, like with things like intrusiveness, not being able to respect boundaries. They maybe are really demanding on your time. It might be someone who really struggles to accept responsibility and blames everyone for things that happen to them. It might be pitting you against other family members. It might be triangulation, so kind of causing problems between other people or another family member because they don't want to confront someone directly. It might be lying. It might be control tactics. It might be verbal, physical, or otherwise assault, either overtly or covertly. So this is really, really broad, and I think one thing to add on top of all of your other beautiful recommendations, Kat, would be to start to notice and recognize what you respond to. So where does your energy leave? So when we're talking about protecting your energy, notice, I guess, what we find the most draining or starting to recognize patterns that cause us to feel quite drained or affected by some of the dysfunctional relational patterns that might be happening. So really paying quite close attention to how you feel around these people and what they might be doing, noticing things like muscle tension, headaches, irritability, confusion, and really just limiting your contact or exposure to these people and to these behaviors. So absolutely, like Kat was saying, boundaries can sometimes be really difficult. So it might mean something as small as just looking at where you're seated. So if it is, you know, around a Christmas dinner, for example, not sitting next to or near someone that might be sucking or draining energy from you. It might be just making sure that you're not engaging in certain conversations around certain topics where this behavior really takes place. It might be that you just remind yourself that no is a complete sentence. So you do not need to justify a why or an explanation for why you may not want to do something. Again, this may be really, really difficult, but no is a complete sentence. It's okay to say no to something that doesn't feel safe to you. But I completely agree with Kat. Your best strategy is to protect yourself by setting clear boundaries where you can. For example, it might be for those that are very insecure and constantly want your validation and reassurance, that instead of trying to fix things for them and trying to give them advice that they then maybe don't listen to, which then becomes quite draining, or maybe when you do give them advice, they get angry at the advice you've given, or you know, nothing you say is helpful for them. There's always a "oh, but this," "oh, but that." Saying something instead like, "I'm so sorry to hear that you're feeling this way, but I know you'll be able to find the right answer in this situation." It doesn't have to be rude, or you know, it doesn't have to be an abrupt conversation. It can just be an empathic way of asserting that boundary there. Is that, well, actually, I'm not going to be kind of used as your emotional dumping ground or a place for you to just vent to because I need to protect my energy in that sense. So not engaging in any arguments, just taking space away from situations that might result in blame or criticism. And then I think absolutely self-care afterwards. So after spending, like Kat was saying, a lot more time with family than maybe you usually would, and that becomes quite draining, making sure that you're engaging in all of the self-care practices that really fill up your cup or recharge those batteries.
Well said, Ames. Alrighty, next question. How do you know when it's time to leave a marriage when there is no betrayal or big reason for it?
Really, really good question. I think we get this question a lot. I would suggest looking into your attachment style. If I was working with this person, I would be looking at getting to the core of any patterns that may be repeating unconsciously here. It would be about understanding active responses from attachment patterning that can cause us to disconnect from self and others. So before making any big decisions, I would be exploring connection to self and needs, because often it can feel like a quick fix to something happening internally. For example, a question I might ask is, if you could have a feast of everything that you ever wanted in a relationship, the best possible scenario was right in front of you. Imagine having it. And for example, someone with an ambivalent attachment style might say something like, oh, I would be really scared. And there might be a physiological signal that you contract and kind of push away. So there's the inner dilemma. And if we don't recognize, I guess, how we're responding to or how we're activated in relationship, it's always then going to be about our partner. So another really important factor to consider is, do you respect your partner, or are there signs of looking for all of the negative things that they're doing and maybe engaging in things like criticism, contempt, defensiveness, stonewalling? Have we lost our fondness and admiration for our partner? Because if negativity has taken over and that negative sentiment override is dominating your interactions, it's likely a good time to look at, okay, well, is there something here that I'm not happy with? You know, are we really meeting each other's needs? And if so, then that may be a signal here. A really easy way to ascertain this is to listen to the story about your relationship. So if someone were to ask you, what is the story? How did you get together? And if your memories are largely positive, you know, if there's a fair dose of, you know, we had a lot of fun when we got together, I really liked X, Y, Z about them, that's a really good indication. However, if negativity takes over, if it becomes difficult to remember any good times, and if you largely focus on bad things, then that might be an indication of what Gottman calls story of us switch, where the light is turned off, negativity takes over, and we begin to assume the worst about each other. And that is where a lot of research really kind of looks at, well, statistically, couples kind of ending or going down the road of ending. So the story of unhappy couples will focus on things like major conflicts, unhappy memories, couples who lack connection, don't have vivid memories. So they will just talk very generally. There will be a lot of impersonal kind of stories, and it will be mainly factual. So it's easy to hear that they've lost that understanding and connection from one another. There will be a focus on individual as well. So rather than that togetherness, a lot of the stories will have me, I, you know, I'm not getting this, they don't do this for me, rather than focusing on, okay, well, we went through a really tough time together, but we were able to overcome it, you know, by doing X, Y, Z together. So the couples that, I guess, are headed down the road to splitting up will prioritize not getting what they want, or focusing on not getting what they want and ignoring everything else. And that can really create a lot of gridlock in arguments, because the focus is on self and then what I'm not getting and my need to prove, you know, why you're wrong and wanting to win the arguments. Okay, and I think another really important component here might also be, how am I expressing disappointment? So how is that coming out in my dialogue? A happy couple might describe knowing that deep down their partner is trying, and deep down, you know, they are generally satisfied in the relationship, and they know that they're right for them, even though they may have faced or might be facing some troubles along the way. So asking yourself, what is the story of us? Might be a good place to start here.
Very well said, Ames.
Beautiful. Alrighty. Next question. How to help children deal with anxiety?
I love that little emphasis on anxiety. This is a really great question. I think lots of children do experience anxiety. I think it's something that is coming more and more to the forefront of parents' minds, of teachers' minds, and of school counselors' minds, which is wonderful. I think something that does help when speaking to children of anxiety is just being really open and honest about it. It's not pushing it aside. It's not dismissing it. It's not trying to change it. I think acceptance of anxiety and education around what it is really helpful. So just some psychoeducation, I think, is a great tool, whether it is you're the parent or you're someone who knows a child who's suffering through some anxiety. You know, learning a little bit yourself about what it is and then coming up with ways to teach children about anxiety and know what it is. I think that's often I see with when I used to work with children and parents that there'd be this almost dismissal or trying to get rid of it. What do we do about the anxiety? How do we make them less anxious and how do we stop them worrying? And I think language like that indicates that A, anxiety is bad, or B, that it's something to get rid of or to fix. And I think that languaging around children is really important to take note of because they're not something to fix. They're not something to try and change. They're just people that need help. They're just people that need a little bit of support and they need some understanding around the way that their brain, their amygdala is working. So I think education around it, there's lots of wonderful, wonderful books. I'm trying to think of, there's one called Hey Warrior that I think I always used to recommend to parents, Hey Warrior, because that really talked about anxiety in a really special way. And I think it created some understanding for children of exactly what their anxiety is and how to cope with it. And I think it was almost befriending anxiety, not trying to get rid of the anxiety.
I used to recommend the same. She has that beautiful quote of teaching kids that I can be worried and do brave.
You can sit with both, right? That, and I think it's anxiety is something to work with, right? So anxiety is something to, you know, live with and accept and to be okay and have some strategies to support. It's not something to try and get rid of forever. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with children because children are very sensitive to picking up on languaging. I think that's something really important to note is the way that you speak about it is so, so important that really that the anxiety is, you know, maybe a superpower, right? That the anxiety or anxious children are very sensitive. They're very thoughtful. They're very kind. I think remembering the positives and the superpower of anxiety, that their brain is a very overprotective smoke alarm, right? That just is trying to keep them safe. And I think using language that's nurturing rather than emphasis on failure or wrong or lacking, I think is really, really helpful here. Maybe letting children know that their brain just works a little differently, right? And there are some tools that they can have in their toolkit that really, really help. You know, children respond really well to breathing. Children respond well to zones of regulation. Children respond well to small tasks that you can do with them that they can learn to have and to use when they do notice some anxiety. So it might even be education with them around what anxiety feels like for them in their body, and how do they know when they start to feel a little bit worried or anxious, or do they know what their triggers might be? And I'm not sure, and age is obviously really important here for the child, but maybe modeling as well, if you're a parent or, you know, have a child in your care or that you look after, modeling, you know, children want to know that they're not alone. Children want to know that other people experience anxiety too. So you might say something like, you know, when mum or dad gets anxious, you know what I do? I take some deep breaths. So let's do that together. Yeah. Can you show me how you take your deep breaths? So normalizing anxiety can be really helpful here too, and modeling some strategies and tools. There's so many great resources out there. I think KidSpot do a lot of work around children and anxiety. There's so many books. Hey Warrior is just one of them, but I know that there is so many more. Just type in literally children anxiety books and you'll be lucky to get out of there with only buying one, because there's so many great, brilliant books out at the moment. I think that those things can be really helpful for children. And if you notice that the child is not coping, or if your children are having that, you know, really significant experience of anxiety where it's impacting on their school or their friendships, then it might be time to maybe get them involved with some therapy or some group work at school or a school counselor. I think that would be really helpful when working with anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Beautiful tips, Kat.
Oh, thanks, girlfriend. Okay, so question number four. What has this podcast done / created for you girls? All right.
I love this question.
Take it away.
For starters, I think it has been such a wonderful venture to share with Kat. And I must say, I've always looked up to Kat and admired her intelligence and just how she accomplishes everything she sets her mind to with such ease and effortlessness. everything Kat sets her mind to, she just does and makes it look so seamless. And I think this podcast has been another one of those things. I think it has created a whole new level of appreciation and admiration for everything that Kat does in and out of our friendship, in like a friendship realm and in a business venture realm. So I think that is something that this podcast has definitely served as, just I guess another reason why I'm so proud and grateful and in awe of Kat, not to sound very
Ames, you're so mushy. Sweet. So kind.
Thank you. But I think secondly, it has been a platform for us to help people, which is what we do. Mm. I wouldn't say we went into the podcast with a really clear goal of where we wanted to be in 5 years or exactly what we wanted to do with it. So there was no kind of clear outline of, okay, by having this podcast, this is what we want to do. But I think our philosophy has always been to try and put out information that is helpful, evidence-based, easy to understand so that people feel less alone in their everyday mental health struggles. And I think we've done that. Mm. So, yeah. Mm. What about you, Kat? Well,
firstly, thank you, Ames. That's so sweet. I almost did start crying when you were talking like that. Oh, thank you. That's so kind. Well, the feeling is mutual. I really think I could definitely not have done any of this without you, Ames. Stop it, keep going. No, I certainly have so much appreciation for you for coming on this wild ride with me. But yeah, the podcast has never had no expectations around it. We literally started it because we were both working with kids at that time, remember? Mm. And we obviously love working with kids because we're big kids ourselves. But we were having a chat. We're like, oh, I just really miss talking to adults or talking with adults or having that kind of adult conversation, because a lot of work with children is, yeah, it doesn't seem to have the same complexities or the same content as I guess what you would have working with adults. So I really think we were both just ready for a bit of a new challenge and to do something a bit different and to fill our cup in another way. And yeah, zero expectation. We went into it very naively. Being like, let's give this a go. So yeah, I think it's created a beautiful community. We've got a really beautiful, supportive online community. I love that. I really think we have, you know, I think we've created something really special there. And yeah, I think as Ames was mentioning, that we always have had the want to just help people, to provide, yes, information that is easily accessible, that doesn't cost anything, that does have some expertise behind it, and just makes people feel less alone. And I really think that I'm so proud of when we get messages or when people tell us that how much maybe the podcast has helped or an episode has really stuck out to them, and how that they feel less alone and know that other people go through something similar. That really always makes me feel so proud. So I think above all, I think the community that we've created, the normalizing that we've created from the very get-go, that's always what we wanted. We didn't realize that we'd kind of get to this level.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very special upon reflection, isn't it? Yeah, very, very special.
It really is. I remember when we had on the podcast hosting app, you can see how many people stream your episodes. You can see the number. Mm. And I so remember our very first episode, upon reflection, it doesn't seem a lot, but then it was heaps. I remember we had 170 people in the first, must have been day, which isn't a lot I guess if you're a big podcaster, but from little old us, we're like, oh my God, 170 people are listening. Like, oh my God, I didn't even know 170 people. Who are these people? So that was so special. And now we're almost at 500,000 streams, which is so cool.
Amazing.
So cool. Yeah. So beyond. So cool. So weird. But yeah, it's so just from little things, big things grow. So we are so appreciative. I think really people that listen, we're so appreciative of you for listening and interacting and communicating with us. We really love that. So yeah, it's done absolutely a lot for us, this little potty.
Absolutely, absolutely. Very, very, very thankful. And I echo everything that you just said, Kat. Moving on to next question, how to address New Year with sustainable goals. And I like that this person has said sustainable.
Yeah, really good emphasis on that. I really do love that because, yeah, sustainability is so important when goal setting, right? I think first and foremost, just acknowledging that you don't have to set goals just because it's a new year. New Year is certainly the time where it feels normal or expected that we should. I think understanding why you're setting goals would be helpful to delve into or reflect on. Is it because you feel like you should or because you genuinely want to? Those two things should be separate, and hopefully it's more because you genuinely want to. If you feel like you should be doing something or you're comparing yourself, likely you will not be able to fulfill those goals because it's probably not for the right reasons. If it is genuinely because you want to and you're motivated, then that's fantastic. And I think, you know, I think it's setting up some SMART goals. So SMART goals is specific, measurable, actionable, realistic, and timely. And they are goals which you can set for yourself. You can start to chunk them down. You can give them dates. How is it going to look over the long term of the year? What's sustainable? What is realistic? I think that's helpful. I think there's so much information on SMART goals. I'm sure everyone has heard of SMART goals, but if you haven't, have a little Google. That's a great way to set goals. And I think as well with sustainable goals for the new year, it's, you know, addressing as well, not what you want to achieve, but how do you want to feel, right? How do you want to feel next year? Do you want to feel adventurous? Do you want to feel accomplished? Do you want to feel connected? I remember last year, Ames, we did that. What word do we want to word, feel? Yeah, the word of the year. So
God, I chose frugal.
Hey, Black Friday, you did well. You were frugal.
Thank you.
I forget
thank
what you mine was.
Yours was play.
Play. Oh my gosh. And then it was a pandemic. Played with fire. So yeah, I think often having the word of the year, what's your word or what do you want to work towards or what do you want to feel next year? I think that can be a great way. If you're not sure on your goals, if you do want to set some, you're just not sure. How do you want to feel next year? That can be a really great way to, to set some goals and to have that thought process behind them. So understanding the why, and if the why is because you genuinely want to and you feel, you know, it's within line with your values and goals, then absolutely go for it, making sure they maybe fit in the SMART goals or, you know, maybe it's in line with how you want to feel, not what you should feel you should be doing or that you should be comparing yourself to someone or you're doing this for another reason. I think those things are really important to reflect on before you set those goals and what's sustainable, you know. So I love that. I hope that that has been helpful in setting those sustainable goals.
Absolutely. Love those little tips for creating sustainable habits that I guess I really love. And I guess originally when we said what our word was, I was a little bit like, yeah, word. But I agree. I think, again, professionally and personally, knowing your why is so important because motivation isn't always there. So when you have something to come back to, it really helps when we say sustainable, create, you know, I guess those small steps that then lead to behavioral habits that then lead to change. So that's how we get there. I love that.
Yeah. And also the kindness and compassion. If you can't reach your goals or if you fall short, I think that's important to note because in January we've got so much energy and motivation. It's almost feels, it may feel a bit more simple to stick to those goals, but you know, it's okay. If not, maybe if you're not ticking it off or if you're not on track, then maybe it's, we need to change
expectations.
Yeah. That maybe it's maybe not realistic or it's not within a realistic time frame. So maybe it's about looking at those expectations, but also maybe adjusting the goal, and just being kind to yourself and compassionate if you cannot reach them or if something happens. I mean, this year, last year we had a pandemic that I think maybe impacted on a lot of people's goals. So sometimes things do happen, and having that compassion and understanding of self can be so important as well. Alrighty, next question. Can you please speak on the topic of defensiveness?
Why, yes, we can.
It's December. Sorry. We're tired.
Defensiveness is a response, but it also has a function. So, for example, defensiveness can protect emotional wounds left by trauma and or abuse if it is a response. I guess one thing to keep in mind is that often a lot of trauma happens in relationships. So we have a lot of, I guess, relational triggers and responses that are unconsciously activated. So we become defensive when we feel threatened or when we are trying to protect ourselves from things like shame or fear or embarrassment. But at the same time, defensiveness can really prevent connection and effective communication. So it can be a little bit of a double-edged sword. In relational patterns, it can often be a crossroads in our system, and this is quite common for people who are ambivalently or disorganized in their attachment style. So it's that I want to be close to you, but I'm scared of abandonment, or I'm scared that I'm unlovable. So we have to uncross these by having an anchor or a safe place for our attachment system to land. So just like the adaptive mechanism denial, defensiveness helps slow down change. We cling to the familiar and defend the foreign, especially when it helps give us power, control over situations that may have otherwise felt quite disempowering. So when we acknowledge defensiveness, it gives us room to grieve our losses. It allows us to be a little bit more curious or open to curiosity and adapt to change over time. Oftentimes we are more easily able to notice defensiveness in others than we are in ourselves. So it's a lot easier to recognize this in other people than it is to see it in ourselves and acknowledge it in ourselves, because oftentimes it is that unconscious response. So sometimes becoming more aware of self can be a really good place to start if this question is in regards to self and your own responses. So noticing how your body feels, you might feel tension in your shoulders. You might feel like your whole body tenses or your chest feels tight. You might notice that you become quite angry or anxious when this response comes up. We can also become defensive around self, so our own internal judgments. Noticing the stories we tell ourselves can be really, really helpful here. So defensiveness to avoid shame, embarrassment, humiliation can arise when we have a narrative of never feeling good enough. So pausing to acknowledge that inner experience can be really helpful, and I guess creating a little bit more space for vulnerability to sit here, which is a lot easier said than done. But again, really going back to developing self-compassion, creating space to identify, where this might be coming from and how I might be relating to this. In regards to other people's defensiveness, accepting our own defensiveness can actually help when it comes to other people, because we understand where it's coming from and how it might be functioning. So we're able to take it a little bit less personally. It can help to separate the behavior from the person as well, which can help if we tend to have a bit of a freeze response, because it is that trying to connect with someone who activates a threat response when they're defensive. So that can feel very destabilizing and disempowering for our nervous system. So again, that post-conversation self-care. After a difficult conversation where someone might be really defensive and that really activates you, things like journaling, movement, going for a walk, talking to another friend or a trusted person about it, again, inquiring if you have been triggered and really caring for that part. If this is happening quite a lot, if you're noticing defensiveness more and more and it is having quite an impact on you, I would also recommend seeking therapeutic support, whether this is happening in a couple dynamic. If you notice that you're having a lot of conflict with your partner and you're both quite defensive, which leads to conflicts very rarely being resolved. It could be helpful to see a counsellor for couples therapy or even just individual support in navigating your own responses, whether it be someone who is defensive triggering you or whether it be that you feel like you're quite defensive. Either way, therapy would be a really instrumental tool to help work through that.
Very well said, Ames. Love that.
Last question, how to snap out of a never-ending bad mindset?
Good question. I firstly am sorry that you're feeling like that. I think that's really tough to be stuck in a loop, or I think it also sounds stuck. It sounds like this person is experiencing some stuckness, so of not being able to get out of this mindset, and it can feel so out of control sometimes being in that loop or that never-ending bad mindset or negative mindset. I'm not sure what this person means by bad mindset, but I'm assuming that it's obviously quite negative and maybe impacting on their everyday, whether it might be their work, their socializing, their relationships. So I think if it's getting to that level, then it may need some extra intervention. Often something like feeling stuckness or being in a negative loop or in a negative state for a long amount of time may be symptomatic of a mental health concern or diagnosis such as depression or a mood disorder. If you're feeling as though you've been in this, as you mentioned, never-ending bad mindset for a while, then I just wonder if maybe there's something else going on beneath the surface. You know, if you're noticing that your usual strategies to help you feel a little bit better or to lift your mood or to care for self are not working, then I would recommend that you maybe have a chat to a therapist, a psychologist, just to explore what's going on. I would hazard a guess and say that if you're stuck in this mindset or you're feeling like you just can't get out of it, that something has triggered it, something has happened to make you feel like this or made you feel a bit stuck. So I would just say if things aren't improving, I would certainly urge that you do speak to someone, just because this certainly can be symptomatic of a mood disorder or another mental health diagnosis. So I would recommend even doing some research or chatting to your GP or a therapist or a counselor. I think that'd be really, really helpful here in dealing with this. But I think as well, just away from that, it is caring for self above all. If you're feeling stuck in this loop, I think it's practicing your self-care, looking at your habits, looking at your routine, seeing if there's anything that you can do to look after yourself, whether it is having a routine every single day, whether it's making sure you're getting exercise, you're eating well, you're connecting with friends and family, you're getting outside, you're getting some sunshine. I think just the basics, Ames and I always talk about the basics, right? I think those are so, so important, these things. I think having those and looking at your how you care for yourself and looking at your overall well-being from a very holistic point of view and seeing if there's anything that you can change, you know, if there's anything you can add into your routine, whether it might be maybe some journaling to jot down some of those thoughts, or maybe it is doing some emotional regulation, maybe it might be doing some breathing, it might be doing some mindfulness exercises, might be doing more self-care, looking after yourself. I think if you're stuck in this negative or this, you know, bad mindset, as this person asked, it's exploring, has something triggered it? Where did this start? Is there anything I can do to help myself to feel or to improve my mood? And if not, if things still aren't improving, then it might be time for me to chat to someone. That would be my thoughts on that question.
Beautiful, beautiful.
All right, Ames. Thank you so much for joining me on your Wednesday afternoon. We are so close to the finish line. And what a year we've had, my friend. Thank you for joining me and coming on the mic at 6 a.m. sometimes, 8 p.m. sometimes, rain, hail, or shine.
Right back at you, girlfriend. I think that is all we have time for today, but we will be back in your ears next year. We hope that you have a beautiful Christmas and a safe and happy new year. And we look forward to speaking to you then.
All right, guys. Stay safe. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. If you're not already, please follow us on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters. We are also now providing online psychological sessions. For more information, please follow us at The Psych Collaborative. See you next time.